Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into the Book of Lamentations. It's not exactly a book that's on everyone's, top 10 list of favorite Bible reads.
It's true.
But it does hold a special place in Jewish tradition.
Absolutely. Lamentations is central to Jewish tradition. In fact, it's read aloud during a special service on Tisha B'Av.
Tisha B'Av.
It's a day of mourning to commemorate the destruction of the temples in Jerusalem.
Oh, wow. That's powerful. So we're dealing with a text that really speaks directly to, grief and hardship.
It does.
And I'm guessing that to truly unlock its power, we need to understand its historical and theological context.
You got it. To really grasp the impact, of something like, let's say, the fall of Berlin in 1945.
Okay.
You really have to understand everything that came before it, even going all the way back to World War I. It's the same with Lamentations.
I see. So, we need to go back to the world in which it was written.
Yes, to really appreciate it.
Okay, so let's start with the basics then.
Sure.
Where does Lamentations even fit into the biblical canon? I know in the Christian Bible, it's placed after Jeremiah.
Right, but that placement can be kind of misleading.
Oh.
You see, in the Hebrew Bible, Lamentations is actually grouped with four other scrolls. There's Ruth, Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes, and Esther. And what unites them all is that they're read during festivals or holy days.
So it's like a special occasion reading list,
You could say that.
Each book linked to a particular event or theme. Okay, so why is Lamentations after Jeremiah in the Christian Bible then?
Well, for a long time, it was believed that Jeremiah wrote it. But scholars today have largely dismissed that idea.
So we don't know who wrote it?
We don't know for sure.
Mysterious. But even though we don't know the author for certain, the book's connection to the Babylonian exile is clear.
Oh, absolutely.
That period of immense suffering for the people of Judah.
Right. And it wasn't just about, a change of location. The exile was a catastrophic upheaval. Imagine your home, your sacred temple, your entire way of life just ripped away.
That's got to be devastating.
It's a loss that was deep.
So how do you even begin to process that kind of grief?
Well, that's where the cultural context becomes really important. Ancient Israel had a very different approach to grief and mourning than, say, modern Western society.
Yeah, we're not exactly known for being, emotionally expressive.
No, not really. Back then, mourning rituals and lamentations were like an integral part of their culture.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Think public weeping, tearing of clothes.
Wow.
Even sitting in silence for days. There's this powerful description in the book of Job.
Oh, yeah.
Where his friends sit with him on the ground for 7 days and night without speaking a word. Can you imagine that happening today?
I mean, I could barely get through a meeting without someone checking their phone.
Right. It's a totally different world.
So do we see these ancient mourning practices reflected in Lamentations?
Absolutely. The book is filled with vivid descriptions of these mourning behaviors. Weeping bitterly, sitting in silence, stretching out hands for comfort. Even physical manifestations of grief, stomach churning, heart ringing.
It doesn't sound like they were holding back.
Not at all. And I think it challenges us to reconsider our own approaches to grief and suffering.
It makes you realize how much we, try to suppress grief these days.
Absolutely.
So the exile wasn't just a historical event.
No, it wasn't.
It also had some pretty deep theological implications, right? How did the people of Judah understand what was happening to them?
Well, for them, the destruction of Jerusalem wasn't just a military defeat.
Right.
It was a spiritual crisis, a sign of God's judgment.
Hmm.
And that belief was woven into their whole understanding of the covenant with God.
So they saw their suffering as a consequence of their own actions, like their disobedience to God's laws.
Yes, and you see that reflected throughout Lamentations. It's not just a cry of pain, but a wrestling with this broken relationship with God.
Like a plea for forgiveness.
Yes, and restoration.
I see.
There's even a direct connection to Deuteronomy 28.
Deuteronomy, really?
Lamentations echoes phrases and ideas from Deuteronomy 28, which specifically lays out the consequences of turning away from God's covenant.
Oh, wow. So Lamentations is like, hey, remember all that stuff in Deuteronomy? Look at us now.
Exactly. They're living the consequences.
So we've got this historical backdrop of exile, a culture that was very comfortable with expressing, intense grief, and this theological understanding of suffering as a consequence of disobedience.
It all comes together.
Yeah, it paints a pretty vivid picture of the world in which Lamentations was born.
It really does.
And to understand even more, we need to explore its connection to another key biblical text, Isaiah. Oh, Isaiah. What's the connection there?
Well, the book of Isaiah, especially the parts written during the exile, seems to be in direct dialogue with Lamentations. It takes those images of suffering and despair, and it intentionally flips them.
Like turns them upside down.
Exactly. It turns them into promises of hope and restoration.
It's like offering a counter narrative.
A glimmer of light in the darkness.
and this interplay between despair and hope.
It's key to understanding what Lamentations is trying to say. It's not just about wallowing in grief, but grappling with the possibility of redemption.
I like that.
Finding meaning and purpose, even in suffering.
This is already giving me like a whole new perspective on Lamentations.
Good. And we're just getting started.
I'm especially intrigued by this idea of the personification of Jerusalem.
Ah, yes, that's a key literary device that deserves a closer look. Throughout the book, you see Jerusalem, or Zion, depicted as a grieving woman, mourning the loss of her children, her home, her relationship with God.
It's a pretty powerful image.
It's incredibly moving.
Yeah, it makes the grief so much more personal. Yeah,
absolutely. And it makes it relatable, even across centuries.
We're not just talking about the destruction of a city.
No, it's more than that.
But the shattering of a community, a people.
Or identity, every...
Okay, but before we get too far ahead of ourselves, I want to pause here for a second and ask you, our listener, what stands out to you so far? What thoughts or questions are coming to mind?
Yes, take a moment to reflect. What new connections have you made?
And hold on to those thoughts, because in part two, we'll delve even deeper into the history behind the Babylonian exile, exploring those pivotal events that led to the destruction of Jerusalem. Get ready to journey back in time with us. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Last time, we really started to unravel the layers of the Book of Lamentations, exploring the historical and theological context of the Babylonian exile. And it's just amazing how much richer the text becomes when we understand the world it was written in.
It really is like piecing together a complex puzzle. You know, we've got the corner pieces now, the broad strokes of the exile, the culture, the theology. But now we need to zoom in on those intricate details.
Yeah, those details that bring the picture to life.
Exactly.
So let's dig deeper into the events that led to the destruction of Jerusalem, that pivotal moment in Jewish history.
All right. Remember how I mentioned we need to understand the broader geopolitical landscape to truly grasp the fall of Jerusalem?
Yeah, like we can't just focus on the Babylonian siege itself.
Right. We need to go back further.
Trace the events that led up to it. Like
dominoes falling one after another.
Exactly. And I think you used a great analogy last time, that Korean proverb, you know, about the shrimp getting its back broken when the whales fight.
Oh, yes.
So who were those whales in the centuries leading up to the exile?
Okay, so picture this. Ancient Israel and Judah.
Okay.
They were stuck between these two massive empires, Mesopotamia to the east and Egypt to the west.
Like a small bridge connecting two huge land masses.
Perfect analogy. And they were constantly caught in the middle of these two empires fighting for power.
So basically stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Pretty much. And to make matters worse, neither kingdom wanted to be absorbed by a larger empire. They wanted to stay independent.
Which, I'm guessing, led to a lot of political maneuvering?
Oh, yeah. Alliances, rebellions, you name it. It was complicated.
Okay, so we've got this really volatile situation, Israel and Judah trying to hold on to their autonomy.
Yep.
What were some of the key events that really, like, pushed things over the edge?
Okay, so in the 8th century BC, the Assyrian Empire starts to get really powerful, expanding westward under this king, Tiglath-Pileser III.
Tiglath-Pileser. Okay, what was he like?
Think of him as the Napoleon of the ancient world. Ruthless, ambitious, a real force to be reckoned with.
I see where the whale comparison comes in.
Right. So naturally, Israel and Judah saw this expansion as a huge threat.
Of course, no one wants to be conquered.
Exactly. And that's what leads to the Syro-Ephraimite War. Syria and the northern kingdom of Israel,
okay,
they teamed up to try to stop the Assyrians.
So a classic alliance against a common enemy.
Exactly. But here's where things get even more messy. Syria and Israel, they really wanted Judah to join them.
Makes sense. The more, the merrier, right?
Right. Strength in numbers. But Judah, maybe feeling a little too confident because of their mountainous terrain, decided to stay neutral.
Oh, I can already tell this is not going to end well.
Yeah, it was a big gamble. They were playing with fire, really. If war broke out, they would be caught in the middle.
So what did they do?
King Ahaz of Judah, he was in a tough spot, so he makes a pretty controversial move.
What do you do?
He decides to appeal to Tiglath-Pileser for help.
So he sides with the enemy.
Yeah, basically. It was a desperate play.
Did it work?
Well, in the short term, yes. Assyria quickly defeated Syria and Israel, absorbing them into their empire. Judah, they became a vassal state.
So they avoided immediate destruction.
They did.
But at the cost of their independence.
Exactly. Out of the frying pan, into the fire, you know.
Yeah, I've been there. So what happened next?
This kind of set a pattern for Judah. They're constantly trying to play both sides, sometimes cozying up to Egypt, other times rebelling against Assyria when they see an opening.
It sounds like they were walking a tightrope.
Yes, a very dangerous one.
And I bet that tightrope eventually snapped.
You bet it did. The Assyrian Empire eventually falls apart, and who rises to take its place?
I'm guessing the Babylonians.
Bingo. led by the mighty Nebuchadnezzar.
Ah, Nebuchadnezzar, that's a name I know.
Oh, yeah, he's a major player in the story.
So what does he do?
Well, Nebuchadnezzar, he wants to expand the Babylonian Empire. And guess who's standing in his way?
Jerusalem.
You got it. He attacks Jerusalem not once, but twice.
Oh, wow.
First in 597 BC, where he deports a bunch of the leaders and skilled workers.
So they were already weakened.
Right. And then he attacks again in 586 BC.
And that's the big one.
That's the one that leads to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. It's the one that scatters the people of Judah into exile.
And that ultimately is what leads to Lamentations.
It's born out of the ashes of this catastrophe, the loss of everything that defined their world.
It's not just a historical account.
It's so much more than that.
It's this raw, honest exploration of grief in all its complexity.
Exactly. But to understand that complexity,
yeah,
we need to go even deeper into the book's literary features.
Like how the author uses poetry and imagery.
Exactly, to express this profound sense of loss and longing.
I'm ready. Let's dive into the poetry of Lamentation.
Let's do it.
Welcome back to our deep dive into Lamentations. It's been quite a journey so far, hasn't it?
It really has.
We've explored the historical backdrop of the Babylonian exile, the theological significance of those events,
the cultural context of grief and mourning in the ancient world.
And now I'm really excited to get into the nitty-gritty of the text itself.
To explore the language, the poetry, the imagery.
Yeah, because Lamentations, you know, it's not just a dry historical account. It's poetry, raw and powerful.
It really is. The author uses all these literary techniques that amplify the emotional impact.
Okay, so let's talk about those techniques. I remember you mentioned acrostics earlier.
Yes.
I have to admit, I'm a little rusty on my poetry terms.
No worries.
Remind me, what exactly is an acrostic?
So acrostic is basically a poem where the first letter of each line spells out a word or a phrase.
Oh, okay. I kind of remember that now.
And get this. The first four chapters of Lamentations are acrostics.
No kidding.
Yeah. Chapters 1, 2, and 4, they follow the Hebrew alphabet.
So each verse starts with a different letter?
Exactly, in alphabetical order.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. But what's the significance of that? Like, why use that structure?
Well, some scholars think it adds a sense of order to the outpouring of grief.
Like, even in the midst of chaos, there's this underlying structure.
Right, it's deliberate, artistic, almost like a subtle hint of hope.
Hope.
Yeah, like a suggestion that even in the darkest of times, there's this underlying order, maybe even a divine plan at work.
That's a really interesting way to think about it. It's like even grief can have form.
Meaning purpose.
Okay, and what about parallelism? You mentioned that too.
Oh, yes. Parallelism, that's another key feature of Hebrew poetry. It's where you have two lines that are related to each other.
Like how?
Well, they might repeat the same thought.
Okay.
Or they might contrast ideas.
Can you give us an example of parallelism in Lamentations?
Sure. In chapter 1, verse 4, we read, "The roads to Zion mourn, for no one comes to the festivals. All her gateways are desolate, her priests groan, her maidens grieve, and she herself suffers bitterly."
Wow, it's like each line just amplifies the grief of the one before it.
It builds and builds.
Really powerful stuff.
And then, of course, there's the imagery. Lamentations doesn't shy away from graphic imagery.
Oh, yeah, I remember you mentioning that. It's not exactly easy reading sometimes.
It's not, but it's powerful.
Can you give us some examples?
Let's see. In chapter 2, verse 11, we read, "My eyes are spent with weeping. My stomach turns. My bile is poured out on the ground because of the destruction of my people, because infants and babes faint in the streets of the city."
Man, those are some pretty disturbing images.
They are, and they're meant to be. It's about confronting the reality of suffering. The author doesn't want to sugarcoat anything.
This is what happened. This is the truth.
Exactly. And by facing that truth, by allowing ourselves to feel the full force of the lament,
we open ourselves up to the possibility of healing.
Of transformation.
Okay. And then there's this powerful image that runs throughout the book.
Yes.
The personification of Jerusalem as a grieving woman.
Such a powerful motif.
It really adds like another layer of emotional depth to the text.
You really connect with it on a visceral level.
So we see Zion, the personified Jerusalem, as this woman who's been ravaged, abandoned,
weeping for her lost children,
her destroyed home,
her broken relationship with God.
It's heartbreaking.
It really is.
And it makes you realize that war, exile,
it's not just about politics.
Right. It has these real personal consequences.
It tears families apart, shatters identity,
leaves lasting scars.
And yet, even in the midst of all this despair, there are these glimmers of hope in Lamentations.
Really?
Yeah. You see prayers, pleas for God's mercy, expressions of trust in his faithfulness.
So it's not all doom and gloom?
Not at all. It's about acknowledging the pain, the suffering.
Yeah.
but also holding on to the possibility of redemption, of finding meaning.
Of finding hope.
Exactly. And that's what makes Lamentations, I think, ultimately a testament to the resilience of the human spirit. You know, it doesn't deny the darkness.
But it points us towards the light.
Towards healing, restoration.
This has been an incredible journey. I feel like I've learned so much, gained a whole new appreciation for Lamentations.
I'm glad to hear that.
It's a book that challenges us, comforts us, and ultimately gives us hope.
I think that's a great way to put it.
And to our listeners, we leave you with this final thought.
Yes.
If Lamentations can teach us to grieve well, to find meaning and hope in the midst of suffering,
how might that change the way we face our own challenges?
What can we learn from this ancient book, its honesty, its faith?
We encourage you to ponder these questions as you continue your own journey of discovery.
Thanks for joining us on this deep ride.
It's been a pleasure.